real one. So if I could ask you first of all then, Mrs. Steele, about your life, you know, what you were doing when war broke out, and how old you would have been then?
I was 14, and I was at school in London, and then, of course, we were evacuated. And so we went down and lived in Sussex with my grandmother, and I finished my schooling about 1941, 42.
Can you remember the outbreak of war, and you know how you reacted to it?
Oh, yes.
It changed your life a lot.
Yes. Well, one couldn't hardly imagine the bombs, and I didn't really experience bombing, but one heard so much about what would happen. And I remember we had to drive up to London just before war broke out and fetch my cousin, and we drove all the way back from London to Crowborough in Sussex with no lights at all in the dark, side lights with tissue paper and a handkerchief over the lights. And so how my mother, who was driving, could see, I don't know. But everyone thought bombs were going to fall the very next day, and we had to get hold of the children out of London.
Do you remember how you felt as a child? You know, did you have any particular image of Germany and what war would be like?
Not really, no. Anyone, what one had seen or heard about the First World War, but it always seemed so very long ago and quite out of one's experience, really. Nothing that one could visualise at all.
At school, you know, you were saying you were evacuated to a different area in Sussex. Whereabouts would that have been?
Crowborough.
You mentioned Crowborough.
Mm-hmm.
That must have been quite a different sort of life for you, was it?
Oh, it was, yes, because I'd been at day school in London, and now we lived with my grandmother, and I was at day school in Crowborough. It was a very small school, but, we had fun. I remember two nuns came to the door once begging, and of course there'd been a lot of scare about parachutists, so we all looked at their feet to make sure that they weren't men.
The fifth column.
That's right, yes. And I remember Blackbring on Crowborough Golf Course, and just dogfights going overhead, and one took it for granted, and it was almost exciting. One didn't really imagine that lives were being lost. It was more like a thrilling experience. It seems awful now to think that, but as a child, one didn't really sort of think in depth about it.
Yes, how old would you have been when war broke out, your age?
I'm 14.
Did you dream that you might be affected and, you know, have to...
Well, no, I thought the war would be over long before I grew up, really. Never occurred to me I'd ever be swept into it at all.
Can you remember when you were aware that you were going to be involved?
Well, I suppose, yes, well, when I left school, I was wondering what to do, and I'd always wanted to be a domestic science teacher, and so I started doing a course of that in Battersea, and after one term, I decided that if the war was going to go on, I really wanted to do something more worthwhile, and so I gave up the course and applied to join the Wrens. Well, in fact, actually, first of all, I applied to join the WAFs because my father had been in the Air Force and my mother had been in the Women's Royal Air Force in the First War, and it seemed right that I should just carry on the family tradition. But the WAFs didn't want me. They were full. And so, no one can believe this, but my second choice was the Wrens, and which I didn't regret because I think it was a very nice service. And so I was called up. I volunteered because I didn't want to be pushed into a factory and I felt I'd like to make my own choice. So when I was 18, I volunteered and was called up in May 1943.
When you say, you know, your second choice surprisingly was the Wrens, does that imply that the Wrens had a sort of higher status?
They seemed to, yes. Everybody said that the Wrens was the best service. I mean, I'm not going to push that at all, because I'm sure that the WAFs and the ATS were extremely good services too, but maybe it was the hats. People preferred the uniform, I don't know.
But was there any sort of propaganda about the women's services, you know, posters?
Not that I can remember. No, I don't remember anything like that. No, not really. Not that I saw, anyway.
Yeah. So what would the procedure have been for actually, once you had volunteered for the...
Well, I was called down to Brighton to have an interview and a medical, and I can't remember how long it all took. I think it was about 3 months altogether. And then I was told to report to Portsmouth, to HMS Pendragon, which is now the Pendragon Hotel, and that was the drafting depot. And so I arrived at Portsmouth, never having been further west than Bognor Regis in my life, and arrived at Portsmouth Station with a rug over my arm and a suitcase to find a lot of other girls doing the same thing. We all caught a bus and ended up at Pendragon Hotel. And there we were initiated into what was expected of us. The first thing I remember being told was that if I died within the next 2 weeks, the Admiralty wouldn't pay for my funeral. And we had various lectures during the first fortnight. We had to call the floor the deck and our bedroom the cabin and all the rest of it. And we walked around Portsmouth in the most awful blue drill, not uniforms, overalls, which we were kitted out with for 2 weeks. And we were probationary wrens, pro-wrens. And then when we'd finished our 2 weeks, if we'd passed, we had to go and collect our uniforms. Well, I'd been brought up in a house with just my mother and my grandmother, and I'd never seen a collar stud in my life, so I had to be shown how to put a collar on, a loose collar on a shirt, which nearly cut my head off for the first week, as it was so stiff. And of course, this was a great thing, having our uniform. And I went home for my first weekend leave. My mother met me at Brighton Station and walked straight past me because she didn't recognise me. And that was the beginning of my Wren experience.
When you say after the first 2 weeks, if you passed, did they give you a test then?
I suppose they must have done. Or they would decide whether you were the right sort of calibre. I mean, maybe if you were very dim or not the sort of girl they wanted, they wouldn't have kept you.
What would your daily routine have been in the early stages? Can you remember?
Oh, yes. Scrubbing floors, peeling potatoes, a lot of chores like that. In fact, we were sent off to a rennery on the front at Southsea in batches, and I remember being given a room and I had to scrub the floor. And as it was already wet from the person who'd already just scrubbed it, I decided it was a waste of my time. So I sat in the window and just watched the ships going by until the time was up. And that was my stint for the morning. But and drilling, of course. We had to drill a lot. We used to walk up and down drilling. And we went to Royal RNB, Royal Naval Barracks, and had to go through a gas chamber without a gas mask on, holding our breath, just run through that. And then I remember walking across RNB barrack parade ground, and a voice came over the loudspeaker saying, "At the double there," because any rating was not allowed to walk. You always had to run. And I suddenly realised they were addressing me, so I had to go at the double across the parade ground. But it was quite enjoyable, and I made some friends, one or two that I'm still in touch with to this day. We joined the same day.
Were you meeting different sorts of people?
Oh, very much so, yes, yes.
From different backgrounds?
Yes, because I'd only been to private schools, and one tended to make friends with people with one's own background, really.
How did you adapt, do you think, after the first fortnight, that first...
Oh, I think pretty badly. I found it was terribly difficult to understand what anyone said from different parts of the country, their dialect. I remember I was terrified of people talking to me. I wouldn't be able to understand a northern accent or a Scottish accent and things like that. But after 3 weeks in Portsmouth, oh yes, once we got our uniforms, I remember three of us walked up and down the front practising saluting each other. And then if we saw an officer coming, we'd hastily cross the road so we wouldn't really have to do it properly. But after 3 weeks, I was sent to Southampton. And I was quite pleased in a way because I was still in the south of England and I could get home. And this, of course, was a combined operation base, HMS Squid. And it was based in Elmfield Flats, which was a block of flats in Millbrook Road. At that time, we lived and worked in the same block of flats. And our signal office, I was actually given the category of messenger, which was the lowliest job you could have in the Wrens. And I kept it, I regret to say, for the entire war, because I was fortunate enough to be attached to the signal office. And whereas a messenger normally would just have an M on their sleeve, denoting their category, we were allowed to have cross flags. And I felt that if I was drafted anywhere else, I'd be away from such an interesting job. And I didn't have very much ambition, so I remained as an SDO messenger. But the signal office was on the top floor of these flats at that time, until, as I recall, one day the window was open and a fairly top-secret signal blew out of the window. And so the signal officer and a few wrens were combing the banks of the main Southampton-Bournemouth railway line looking for the signal, which I suppose they found. But soon after that, we were relegated down to the basement, which had been the garage. And so there we were, down on the sort of cement floor in fairly dark, primitive conditions. And this is where all our operations went on.
Did you have special training for your job as messenger for the signals?
Not really, no. Providing you knew how to use a telephone, and the SDO wrens, the signal wrens themselves, mostly took down the signals. And it was up to the messengers to take them, distribute them, take them round to the different people, which sometimes meant going into a cabin of officers and finding the right one to wake up. And you didn't always wake up the right one. They weren't very pleased. But gradually one was able to do more and more of the work of the signal office. It was really very interesting.
How did you travel around when you were delivering your messages?
Oh, it was just within the base at that particular place, just on one's foot, I mean, in the building.
Mm-hmm. What were the relations like between the other ranks and the officers in the Wrens, from your own experience, would you say?
Well, from my own experience, we really got to know the officers more than the other ranks. Although we were other ranks, and we'd have to salute them in uniform, but socially, we would be taken out to dances and get to know them like that. I suppose really it was a question of background. You know, there were wrens who would feel at home with the ratings. Don't want to be snobby, but as far as I was concerned, I really knew the officers more than the ratings.
Yes, because you were in that sort of environment.
Well, that's right. Yes, yes. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I was wondering also with the women, the Wren officers, you know, and the sort of other ranks, you know, was there any sort of gulf between?
Oh, yes, yes. They were all more like schoolmistresses as far as I was concerned, because having just left school, it was really like a glorified boarding school. We had to be in by 10:30 every night, unless we had a late night pass, which meant we could stay out until 11. But the women officers were pretty strict and made sure that we cleaned our cabins and did our share of whatever it was we had to do. You know, there was a very good discipline. There was very little insubordination or anything like that.
Was there much in the way of spit and polish? You know, did you have to polish buttons and attend to kit and that?
Well, we had to keep our shoes clean. Buttons, we didn't have brass ones because we were rating, so we only had black ones. But, oh yes, you had to be neat and tidy, and your hair had to be off your collar, and you always had to wear your cap and, you know, look spick and span.
Yes. Were you allowed to wear makeup?
Yes, in moderation, not nail varnish, and black stockings, and blackouts, which were one's knickers.
And that was all provided?
That was provided. Your initial kit was provided, yes.
How did that affect your coupons, you know, your clothing coupons?
Well, you didn't have clothing coupons. You had chits, which you could, there were forms which you could fill out, and you could get, as far as I can remember, you got a certain amount of civilian clothing on it. Some shops would honour them and others wouldn't. But, I mean, we didn't have very much. I think I had about one skirt and two jumpers, and that was it. But I went to one shop in Southampton to get new collars once. I don't know why I didn't get naval ones, but anyway, I went into this shop, and it was a lovely old tailoring shop with a dear old man behind the counter. And he said, oh, I always love to serve Nelson's young ladies.
Yes, I was going to ask you how you were regarded by sort of local people, the Wrens.
Oh, I think very, very happily, really. I mean, there were an awful lot of us. We really seemed to swamp Southampton. You know, you couldn't go down the street without meeting lots of naval personnel. And, I mean, we didn't know each other. There were so many, really.
One hears stories with the other services sometimes, that there was a certain amount of sort of public abuse.
Oh, absolutely none. No, none at all. And Southampton had a pretty bad time. I mean, they'd been blitzed. And so I think they were just thankful that the Navy were there, really.
Did you experience anything of that in Portsmouth or Southampton?
No, it was between the Blitz and the flying bombs. I didn't really have anything like that. Until just before D-Day, and I think the first flying bomb, I can't remember if it came over just before or just after D-Day, but I remember that. But, no, Southampton was an interesting place to be because, I mean, everybody knew there was going to be a second front, and we knew that this combined operations was all working up to it. We had exercises each year leading up to D-Day. There was a very large exercise when the Hythe ferry was closed. You couldn't cross Southampton water, and we were very much involved because our signals were always about landing craft and their exercises and where they were, and you know, sort of keeping the fleet in the right place. And there was one exercise the year before D-Day, and I had to cancel my leave, and I was told that I was to go down to the Hard, which is down in the harbour. It was the only time in the war when I had to wear my tin hat. Not that it was really necessary, but we had to look out of the window and see every landing craft that came in, note its exact time, how long it took to load, and when it sailed, and then report this over the telephone back to head office. And so I was told that when the actual thing happened, I would be able to do this job, and I was thrilled. I didn't mind cancelling my leave at all. And then toward the end of the exercise, they decided it wasn't the place for women. And so I had to hand over to a naval rating who was a young lad. I should think he'd come straight off a farm, and he didn't even know how to use a telephone, and I had to show him how to do this job. And so, of course, when D-Day itself came, I was just doing my usual work as a messenger.
How did you feel about that?
What about not doing that job? I was a bit sour at the time. I was rather disappointed. But, you know, one just obeyed one's orders, and that was it.
Would that have been in line with the way women were regarded then, would you say?
I should think it probably was. I mean, it's a very, very different time then to now when they go to sea, there's an awful lot of ill feeling about it. But at that time, yes, I suppose really. Well, it was just an accepted thing that wrens didn't go to sea except the boat crew, and they were kept more or less out of the front line. At least as far as I was concerned, I'm sure there were other women who were manning guns and doing all kinds of things. But I wasn't able to experience that.
What was the sort of intensity of signals? You know, was this building up towards D-Day, would you say?
Oh, yes. It was all exercising and getting the landing craft ready to know what they were going to do, how they were going to land. And I mean, we didn't know the details being way down the hierarchy, so to speak, I mean, the bottom grade, but obviously something big was in the air. And it was all kept very hush-hush, but one just knew it was in the air that something was going to happen fairly soon.
Well, when did the sort of troop build-up start? Were you aware of that?
Oh, very much, yes. We used to bicycle during our off-duty. I remember bicycling up to Winchester and bicycling all around Southampton, and the roads were lined with American troops, stationary. I mean, they'd all sort of converged. It was one big bottleneck in a way. All these huge American lorries full of GIs, and they all whistled at us and threw us Mars bars and bits of chocolate. And it was a question of either being on your dignity and bicycling on, or getting off your bicycle and grovelling in the ditch and picking up the candy, which of course we did because we were on rationing. And one just waved at them and thanked them and went on our way. But also, we did a lot of hitchhiking in our spare time. We thought nothing of hitchhiking up to Salisbury or even up to London to get a free lift. And it's really hairy, some of the things I used to do. I remember being picked up by two Yanks. We always did it in pairs, myself and another girl, and We were picked up by these two Americans who were obviously had far too much to drink. And we were just going all over the road, got to our destination, but I really was frightened on that occasion. Another time we got into the back of the bakery van by Americans, and they said, "Help yourselves, girls, to the doughnuts." And so we had a most marvellous time eating fresh doughnuts. But the Americans were everywhere. Even at dances you met them, and that was pretty awful too, because I never knew how to dance. And I remember one American at the Polygon Hotel saying, "Let yourself go, baby." But I never did get the hang of jitterbugging.
Fling you over his head or anything?
Almost, yes.
How were they regarded, do you think, the American troops?
Oh, as allies. And
for instance, would you have gone out with one as a boyfriend?
I suppose if one had asked me, but I wasn't the type that an American would really look at. I was a much too quiet little English girl.
Is that so? Do you think there were certain girls there?
Oh, I think so, yes. I mean, I was pretty young and naive at the time. I mean, I come straight from school. I'd hardly, hadn't had a boyfriend, never just been to about one dance in my life. And I'm sure there were some girls who would make great opportunity of it. But
was there any particular image, you know, attached to the Americans, would you think?
Well, the usual sort of...
If you'd had a boyfriend, would your parents, for instance, have minded?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think I would probably have chosen a particular quiet sort of person to go with myself, you know. But, you know, mostly the people I went out with were just British, British officers. I mean, they were all R&VR. They weren't, I don't think they were any regular Navy. They were all Naval Reserve.
And you were saying you got on well with the men, the R&VR?
Yes, oh yes,
the
yes,
men. You were
yes.
Respected by them.
Yes, oh yes, yes, indeed, very much so. Mm-hmm. It was a very nice atmosphere, really. We called it our ship. Stone frigate, I think is the word these days.
Did you ever get on the water?
Only going down. I was thinking, first of all, we used to get a trip down to the Isle of Wight on the mail ship, but you weren't allowed to land on the Isle of Wight, but we just went out to sunbathe. Occasionally they'd take us. But the day before D-Day, I was asked with another wren to go on an ML, a motor launch, and we were taken all the way down Southampton Water and down the Solent. And really, our sole purpose was to wave at the men. I should say that this was because, although we weren't aware of it at the time, but D-Day had been postponed for 24 hours because of bad weather. And so the ships were full of these men. They'd all embarked. And, of course, there they were, sitting in Southampton Water and the Solent, and for 24 hours. And so one way of keeping them occupied was to send two wrens down in this ML to wave at them for 40 minutes, and of course we had the most wonderful time on this trip, and the highlight was having tea on the Admiral's flagship, which was HMS Bulolo, and we actually had white bread, because one never had white bread during the war, except on board ship, and that was one of the highlights of that time. And although nobody said to us, "Oh, these men are here, and D-Day is tomorrow," obviously it was very top secret, but one just knew. It was just in the air. I mean, you didn't have to tell us. We were just aware of the fact.
But what was it like, you know, as you were on your launch, going between the ships? Could you sort of describe the scene?
Well, it's such a long time ago. I just remember all these craft, yes, just crowded with men sort of waving at us. I suppose they had somewhere to sleep. I don't know how they managed, really. One didn't think about things like that, but it was quite a picture. And when you think that the Germans could have come over so easily and seen it. And, of course, every night for a week we had a smoke screen in Southampton. At the corners of the streets they had these canisters, and it was like a London fog. And I think it was at, I suppose it was the early evening, and I remember this horrible sort of smell if you walked along the street, which completely shrouded the place and hid what was going on.
Yes, I was wondering earlier when you were saying about the troops, you know, being stationed in all the country lanes around.
Yes, I know.
I suppose they were camouflaged, would they have been?
Well, I suppose to a certain extent, but it must have been you know, German planes were just kept away by the Air Force. I mean, this is where we're so grateful for the RAF for keeping the skies clear, because one German reconnaissance plane, I mean, to me, it's absolutely miraculous that D-Day happened and the Germans thought it was going to be somewhere else. And it was really the most fantastic thing.
And how were you received, you know, as you wove your way between the ships?
Well, I just remember a few sort of waves and hats in the air and things like that, you know.
Did you feel you were playing a role?
I can't remember, really. It was just an outing, as far as I was concerned. It was just a wonderful opportunity to be at sea, for one thing, and to see all the men, and, of course, just to enjoy myself.
So you didn't mind, you know,
no.
Much job. In fact, you seemed to have enjoyed it a lot.
I did, yes, I did enjoy it. And that part of it, I almost felt I'd dreamt, because I didn't tell anybody about it at the time. I felt one didn't talk about what one was doing. And then I went to the museum at Southsea, you know, the D-Day Museum, and they had a chart of all the ships off the Normandy beaches, and there was my ship, HMS Pulolo, off the Normandy beach. I never heard what happened to her after that, whether she got through or was sunk or what. I don't know. That was my little contribution to D-Day.
What was it like having tea, you know? Was the Admiral there for it?
Oh, no. I think an officer was in charge. But, I mean, the very fact that they gave us tea in the wardroom was, well, I just remember sitting at a white tablecloth and tucking in. And then, of course, the general emptiness of Southampton. I mean, we heard on the news that the Second Front had begun, and of course you went out into the streets, there was nobody, no troops, all the ships had gone. It was an eerie sort of feeling.
So you weren't aware of them sort of leaving, is that right?
Yes, well, our Rennery wasn't near the sea, I mean, near the Southampton water, so, but the actual HMS Squid, you know, that was pretty bereft of people, except the shore-based staff.
How about the signals? Did you then find they declined, or were you busy with the sort of Normandy business?
Do you know, I don't remember. They must have declined, must have done, but I just don't remember what we did after that. It was really just sort of signals, more about personnel, I think, drafting and telling people, you know, so-and-so was going to be drafted to Chatham or Portsmouth and things like that. And I remained there for another, I suppose, 6-8 months, as far as I can remember. But I don't remember much about the work after that. I mean, it was 47, 48 years ago, so it's a long time.
There was a lot of coverage at the anniversary of D-Day.
Yes.
You didn't see anything on the film sort of approximating to your craft or yourself. Have you ever seen
No. Well, I mean, all the landing craft look very familiar, of course. There were LSTs and LCTs, and, I mean, all that part of thing. It was just part of our life. But, I mean, there were so many of them, and I wouldn't remember the numbers. It was just a general thing. I mean, it wasn't only Southampton they went from. They went from all along the coast.
Did you ever hear anything about the business at Slapton Sands?
No.
You know the...
Yes, I know about it. No, we didn't hear about that. And, of course, that wasn't our area. You see, we were Force J, and it was very much just around Southampton that we dealt with. And the landing craft would go as far as Chesil Beach, as far as I can remember. But anything further westward, I don't think, came under us, really. And, of course, they kept it very quiet during the war. I mean, we wouldn't hear about things like that.